This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll explore the legacy of French culture and language here in Wisconsin. Through WPR's Wisconsin Project, we heard from two listeners who were curious about French history here. One wanted to know why the state's French place names get mispronounced so often. Another asked us why they haven't noticed a larger French culture in Wisconsin despite the history of early French explorers in the state. We'll get some of his answers in just a bit. Now it's time for a new episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. Earlier this fall, the series brought us back to 2011. That's when Wisconsin's current lines for the state legislature and congressional districts were redrawn by a new Republican majority. Those new maps heavily favored Republicans and helped them keep control of the Assembly and Senate for the last decade. Now the legislature is required by law to draw new electoral maps after the latest census. Those Republican plans were vetoed by Governor Tony Evers. The issue then came before the state Supreme Court, which said a so-called least changes approach should be used in redrawing those lines. And an active federal court challenge to our current maps could still affect the process, too. There's a lot happening. Getting us caught up and looking at what's next is the subject of this week's Mapped Out. As Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden report, when lawmakers from both parties meet to talk about redistricting, it's anything but simple.
There are times in modern politics when, and this is an understatement, it really sounds like Democrats and Republicans are talking about completely different things.
Like, they could be debating a bill, and it sounds like they're not even talking to each other. It's as if they're on totally different planets.
Take the public hearing on the legislature's proposed redistricting plan this year. Remember, these are the maps that will shape Wisconsin's political boundaries for the next decade.
Good morning to all the members and to the chairman.
Robin Voss, the powerful Republican Assembly Speaker, is testifying in favor of maps his party has drawn. The maps at this point are bills, and he's the lead author.
To be clear, it is the duty of the state legislature, as laid out in our state constitution, to, quote, apportion and district anew the members of the Senate and Assembly.
Voss is bragging about the new maps. He says they meet all the legal requirements of redistricting and should be passed.
But when Democrats get a chance to ask questions of Voss, a pattern emerges. They want to talk about the old maps, the ones Republicans passed in 2011.
And if you've listened to this podcast, some of it might sound familiar. Jeff Smith, a Democratic senator, alludes to the non-disclosure agreements Republicans had to sign to look at their districts that year.
Since you signed our non-disclosure agreements in 2011, is that done, or can you talk about 2011 now, or?
You know, it's interesting that you would choose that vein of questioning, because what we have before us, I was not speaker. I was not in charge of redistricting in 2011.
You were in the legislature, and you signed one of those non-disclosures.
Yeah, I was in the legislature.
And Kelder Royce, a Democratic senator from Madison, wants to talk about the last maps, too.
We can agree that that happened. It was widely reported at the time. I just want to make sure that the record is clear that that did happen and that members in this room did sign those secrecy oaths. Now,
well, first of all, let me just correct that, okay? You are using terms meant to incite an opinion, right? A secrecy oath, right?
More than an hour into the hearing, it's clear that Voss has had it. He doesn't want to talk about the old maps anymore.
What it is, because you want to talk about the past, I want to talk about the future.
On the surface, this sounds like one of those political moments where both sides are talking past each other.
But this time, they're actually talking about the same thing. Because the new maps, the ones Voss is proposing, are based on the old maps.
We know that the map drawn in 2011 was a good one for Republicans. So this is going to be a critical question over the next few months. Can this map that helped cement GOP power for the past decade be reused for the next 10 years?
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
The story of redistricting in Wisconsin is full of intrigue and drama. It's a political thriller with twists and turns along the way.
But there are some things that we always knew were going to happen this year. We knew Republican lawmakers would pass maps, and they did.
There are 60 ayes, 38 nays, Senate Bill 621 is concurred in. Gentlemen from the...
We knew Democratic Governor Tony Evers would veto those maps, and he did.
These gerrymandered maps will not become law.
So that's where we are. But it's not about the destination, it's the journey.
So even though this part of the story was the most predictable, it's noteworthy. And it's important because it's setting up the legal fight that will actually decide what Wisconsin's new political maps will look like.
Let's start from the beginning. As you know, redistricting starts with the census. This year, the results were delayed because of the pandemic.
So redistricting didn't really get started until August. That's when the first lawsuits were filed.
And in September, the legislature took its first votes on redistricting. Sort of. GOP lawmakers introduced a joint resolution that spelled out their priorities for drawing maps.
A joint resolution. This is not a bill. It's non-binding. It's the legislature saying, here's what we think.
There wasn't much debate on this resolution when it came up for a vote, and the only Republican to speak was Assembly Speaker Voss, who said it was the legislature's duty to handle redistricting, not the governor or the courts.
So hopefully, you won't just continue to take the no way, no how, never route, which is kind of where you've been before, and accept the fact that this resolution lays out the principles that we are going to utilize to ensure that we have a map that will last during the next 10 years, just like the last one has during the past decade.
But it's just a resolution. It doesn't actually require anything. It doesn't go to the governor's desk. It's not law.
At the end of the day, it's the legislature saying, we, the legislative branch, get to do redistricting. And here are the principles we value, because we said so. We're the legislature.
Among those principles, one person, one vote. Comply with the Voting Rights Act. These are required by the U.S. Constitution and federal law.
Also on the list, draw districts that are compact and contiguous and avoid splitting up local boundaries. These are required under the Wisconsin Constitution.
But this Republican resolution also included redistricting criteria that are not required, like avoiding putting two incumbents in the same district.
And this one is key, retaining as much as possible of the core of existing districts.
In other words, keep as much as possible of the map Republicans drew a decade ago. So, as you might imagine, Democrats like Mark Spreitzer were not happy.
This latest resolution is just more of the same, trying to cling to power and saying anything you can in order to come up with a justification for doing that.
This resolution passed, and when the Republican maps came out in October, they were pretty true to the principles it laid out.
And because of that, the 2021 map looked a lot like the 2011 map. When you retain as much as possible of existing districts, like the resolution said, you end up not making a lot of changes.
In the world of redistricting shorthand, this is often referred to as core retention. But University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor Rob Yablon has a different name for it, gerrylaundering.
Gerrylaundering is an attempt to perpetuate an existing biased map by carrying forward the existing lines with as little change as you can get away with.
The idea of core retention, where you preserve an existing map, is definitely not new in redistricting, but by no means is it a widely accepted norm.
Yablon found that of all 50 states, only three have laws or constitutional provisions that endorse core retention. Wisconsin is not among them. And in 2011, core retention was not a priority for Republican map drawers.
Yablon says another red flag is the way Republicans want to avoid incumbent pairing.
But what does that mean? Okay, think of it this way. The legislature's full of Republicans. Pairing them means changing the lines so that more than one incumbent ends up living in the same district. That means they'd have to run against one another, and only one of them could stay.
When a map avoids incumbent pairing, it avoids those fights. The incumbents get to stay. In other words, it means fewer of them are at risk of losing their jobs. On the whole, more GOP lawmakers are protected.
Again, this is not unheard of in the world of redistricting, but it's not a hard and fast rule. Republicans didn't follow it 10 years ago. In Wisconsin, it's not required by state law or the Constitution. And Yablon's research found several states actually ban mapmakers from favoring incumbents.
Which is why Yablon, who testified against Wisconsin's Republican-drawn maps, says Republicans are gerrymandering.
It's clear that the goal for the Republicans and the legislature is to carry forward as much of the existing gerrymander as they can.
Now, you won't hear Republicans use words like gerrymander or gerrylander to describe their map, but they've definitely talked about carrying forward the existing map, which they say is a good one.
But as you might remember, Democrats, including Governor Tony Evers, have decidedly different views on those 2011 Republican maps. And Evers promised an alternative this year, drawn by his People's Maps Commission.
And the People's Maps proposal, while it was hotly debated on the floor, didn't go anywhere. Even some Democrats voted against it.
So what did pass? The Republican plan.
What that meant after the break.
We're listening to the latest episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out. After digging into the history of Wisconsin's current electoral maps earlier this fall, we're now hearing about what happens next as the state draws new district lines. We'll also talk about redistricting here on Central Time in the weeks, possibly months ahead. If there's part of the process that you want to hear more about or someone you want to hear discuss it, let us know. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. We'll hear more from Mapped Out in just a bit. That's coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're listening to a new episode of WPR's Mapped Out podcast. We're getting caught up on how the state's drawing its new electoral maps. The big question for lawmakers was how much to revamp Wisconsin's current districts, which gave Republicans an advantage since they were drawn 10 years ago. Here's more from Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden.
So Democrats call the GOP redistricting plan gerrymandering. Republicans have another way to describe it.
They call it a least changes map. In other words, adjusting the 2011 map for population changes and not much else.
There are practical reasons Republicans would want to do this. Obviously, the last map was really good for them. They like it. And it mostly survived multiple lawsuits. So if you think the new map is going to court, the old map? Not a bad place to start.
But if you take a close look at the map, the new Republican map, there are some places where the changes are significant. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University. He studies redistricting trends and data.
It's very clear that they don't change the districts that they like, and they do change the districts where they think that they can either pick off a Democrat or shore up a Republican who needs help.
In other words, this map that Republicans call least changes does make strategic changes that benefit their party.
A good example of this is in Milwaukee's suburbs, where there are communities that have been changing over the past decade. The only seats Democrats flipped under the old map are in these suburbs. It's really the only part of the map where Republicans are threatened.
If you look at those districts, the competitive suburban districts, you get a pretty good snapshot of the decisions Republicans made in their new map.
We'll get really specific with one example here to give you a better idea. In Wisconsin, three assembly districts are nested inside every Senate district. So let's focus on one state Senate district and its three assembly districts.
So the Senate district first. It's held by Republican Dale Coinga of Brookfield. He won his last election by just 2.5 percentage points. And according to Johnson's research, the district actually has a slight Democratic lean.
So what do the assembly districts look like? Well, they include two of the only seats Democrats were ever able to flip in the last decade, currently held by Sarah Rodriguez of Brookfield and Robin Vining of Wauwatosa. And the third assembly district is held by Republican Joe Sanfilippo of New Berlin.
In the new map, Republicans make trade-offs. Vining's assembly district gets a lot more Democratic. It all but guarantees Republicans will never win there.
But at the same time, the other two assembly districts get a lot more Republican. Rodriguez's district goes from super competitive to safe Republican. And Sanfilippo's seat gets extremely red.
In essence, Republicans made a two-for-one deal with these assembly seats. But the real prize for them is in the Senate, where Dale Coinga's seat would also get safer.
Which is why Marquette's John Johnson says it's wrong to call the latest Republican map least changes.
I mean, who cares about a least changes map? Like, no one actually believes that that matters. I've never met anyone who sincerely believes that that's, like, a legitimate goal for a map. like, seriously, like, no one cares about that. So I struggle to even respond to that because I think it's such a disingenuous point.
When you look at all the changes on this map, based on Johnson's analysis, Republicans would be expected to win 63 seats in the Assembly, up from the 61 they have now. And in the Senate, Republicans would be expected to win 23 seats, up from 21.
That would leave Republicans just a few seats away from winning a supermajority. So if Republicans had a good year, they could win enough seats in the legislature to override a governor's veto. GOP lawmakers could run things in Wisconsin, even more than they do now.
But like everything connected to redistricting, especially this year, what's okay and what's not is really up to the courts. And a least changes map is at the heart of the redistricting case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
The case was brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, a conservative law firm that files high-profile lawsuits with the state Supreme Court on a regular basis.
The argument in WILL's redistricting lawsuit goes like this. It's the legislature's job to redistrict. But when there's split government, like there is this year, that's probably not going to happen.
And so, without a new map signed into law, Will argues the next best alternative is the old map, because it passed the legislature, was signed by a governor, and already survived lawsuits.
Democrats, as you might imagine, don't care for this argument. A bunch of Democrats filed briefs, including Bill Whitford and other plaintiffs from Wisconsin's famous redistricting case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. They accused conservatives of asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to do their dirty work.
They had a couple reasons. For one, they don't accept that least changes or core retention is a valid legal principle for redistricting. Beyond that, they say it's not fair because it could entrench the 2011 GOP gerrymander for another decade.
While the legal battle over redistricting isn't over, on November 30th, the Wisconsin Supreme Court did answer this major question. Is a least changes map okay? And their 4-3 majority opinion said, unequivocally, yes.
Writing for the majority, conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley more or less adopted Will's argument. Maps are political decisions, she said, and those are for the legislature to make, not the court.
The court also said it would not look at the partisan makeup of districts. That meant justices would not try to draw a map that's more balanced. Bradley said that would be decidedly non-judicial.
And the court kept going. Conservative justices said they would not decide any partisan gerrymandering cases, like the original Whitford case, the one brought by the Watts Tea Room Group. Remember, the U.S. Supreme Court closed the door to these cases in federal court. Now the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering cases aren't allowed in state court either.
And Justice Brian Hagedorn, the court's swing vote, who everyone was watching, he mostly joined the majority opinion. Hagedorn said legislatures are allowed to draw partisan maps, and it's not the court's place to make political judgments.
The case isn't over. The court still gets a chance to approve specific maps eventually, and a federal court could still weigh in. But this ruling was, without a doubt, a huge win for Republicans, because the map they got to draw after they won big in the 2010 election, that helped them cement their majorities for a decade, could live on until at least 2032.
2032. Between now and then, lawmakers will come and go. The political pendulum will swing. But maybe not in the legislature.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
Here on Central Time, we'll keep an eye on what comes next in the redistricting process with future conversations and updates and your opinions along the way. If there's an aspect of redistricting that you want to hear more about on the air, let us know. You can email us with your topic ideas, your guest ideas at centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Or tweet us at centraltimewpr. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, another issue we've been following on our talk shows here on the Ideas Network, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the recent U.S. Supreme Court hearing on a Mississippi abortion law, with a ruling expected sometime in the next half year or so, and find out why it could change things in states like Wisconsin. Join in with your questions and your opinions on what you hope comes out of that Supreme Court decision. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Last week on Central Time, we had a conversation about the science of smell with Jude Stewart, author of the new book Revelations in the Air. We found out about the chemistry of smell, the brain science, and maybe most important, why smell is so connected to our memories. We invited you to share smells that connect you to a moment, a time in your life. Here's a couple more that you shared on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy wrote, lilacs, the smell of lilacs. Brandy says, reminds me of my grandma's house. Boring, I know, but not to me. I don't think that sounds boring. Brandy, thanks for sharing that with us. And MC wrote, fresh Crayolas. Brings back nothing but good memories of spending hours coloring alone or with my cousin. Share your smell memories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out the archive of that conversation at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now sit down, relax, and grab a cup of coffee with a croissant because it's time for Wisconsin. Wait, is it croissant or is it croissant? I'm not actually sure, so we asked a native French speaker to help me out.
Hi, my name is Jean-Marc Poisson. I'm from Paris. Croissant.
Let's hear that one more time just to make sure we got it right.
Croissant.
Okay, why all the talk about croissant? Well, a listener named Jan got us wondering. Jan sent us this question through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Jan writes, I am so amazed that so many people in Wisconsin mispronounce the French names of places such as Prairie du Chien and Fond du Lac. Why? Joe Sammons is with us, professor of linguistics at UW-Madison's Department of Language Sciences. He studies sound changes as well as immigration and language in Wisconsin. Or as the French called it back in the 17th century based on their interpretation of the Algonquian name,
Wisconsin.
Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you could say croissant or croissant in a couple different ways. The same is true for a lot of French place names. Before we get into specific names, our asker said, why do we pronounce them wrong? Whenever I talk to people who talk about linguistics, they're a little nervous about saying right or wrong ways. Is there a right or wrong way?
Well, there are established ways. We don't, most of us in the state don't speak French, and so we don't ask for a croissant, and we don't say fond du lac, and that's just part of the way it works. So I would say those are not wrong. They're established local norms, and those local norms change over time.
All right, let's go to our French speaker here, Jean-Marc Poisson. That last name strangely familiar. Here, let's hear him say some of these names, starting with Prairie du Chien.
Prairie du Chien.
Here's Racine.
Racine.
Portage.
Grand Chute.
Oh, we jumped ahead to Grand Chute there. La Pointe.
La Pointe.
and Benoit.
Benoit.
Okay. So can you talk about patterns of language change, how they go from that original French to what are Racines and Prairie du Chien's?
Sure. We always have to substitute sounds. So when he said Prairie du Chien, he said chien. We don't have that nasalized vowel, as we call it, in English. Most English speakers can't pronounce it, so we have to adjust. And the natural way to adjust that is to say an N at the end. So we've adjusted things just like we do with any kind of personal names, just like with words that we borrow from other languages. You had the perfect example there with croissant.
Now, if I were to ask someone for directions to Le Poix, I mean, I guess I get points for technical correctness in French. I probably wouldn't get where I'm going. When? How does it settle in? What's the breaking point from that original pronunciation to where we lock in on our Englishified pronunciation, if I can, I think, make up a word?
Well, when we had large numbers of French speakers, as, you know, the bulk of the population in the state, people traveling through, establishing things, you're going to have people who could pronounce things in a French-like way. Of course, that quickly changed early in the history of the state, and it's stayed changed ever since. So, but just because it gets set one way doesn't mean it stays that way forever. Something I'm really curious about is I've heard many times people say that Prairie du Chien used to be Prairie du Chien, that it used to just have that one, they lost the final vowel of the first part. People don't really say that much. I've heard it maybe once or twice in the wild, but people really don't use it that way. So even when you get that set, when you get a sort of an English-like pronunciation, that doesn't mean it's not going to change from there.
We're talking to Joe Selmans, professor of linguistics at UW-Madison's Department of Language Sciences. We're answering the first in a pair of Wisconsin questions about French influence in Wisconsin. Right now, talking about French place names and how pronunciations have changed over time from the original French examples, we just heard a bunch of them, to what we say now. Now, is this really particularly true of French names, or do we see it with place names from other languages that we have here in Wisconsin?
Well, of course, it's across the board because most people in the state don't speak Ho-Chunk, they don't speak Ojibwe, they don't speak German, they don't speak all of these other languages. So it's a general pattern for sure.
There's a big story about how pronunciations change over time, and it's not just place names. You gave an example to our producer, I think, about the word taco and the story of your wife eating tacos in California.
Yeah, so back in the 70s when most people in the upper Midwest didn't really know about tacos. She moved to California where tacos were a thing, as the young people say now, and came back to visit, and a relative invited her over for tacos. And early on, as that was a relatively new food item, a lot of people use a heavily anglicized pronunciation, but we've now shifted back to something that's a little more Spanish-like. We don't say it like a Spanish speaker. Our T is very different from a Spanish T, but we've now changed that vowel to be much more Spanish-like.
Now, how about localized pronunciations of places? Like, so my grandpa spent a lot of his life in Port Huron, Michigan, and always talked about his days in Port Yorn.
Yep. This is a really interesting thing. We have local pronunciations that mark you as knowing at least the local territory, even if you're not terribly local. One of the ones that struck me when I moved here was I was going to bicycle. I was in Sturgeon Bay, and I was going to bicycle down to Two Rivers. And a person from Sturgeon Bay asked me, where are you going to bike to today? And I said, Two Rivers. And she said, oh, no, don't say that. It's Trivers. And sure enough, it is. But there's a really interesting pattern where words that we use a lot, whether it's a place name or a personal name or something else, we tend to say them faster and reduce them so that you get the Milwaukee kind of thing for Milwaukee. And Trivers is part of that. And I think your Michigan example fits the same pattern.
It was just dawning on me as you say it. It's all three of those examples are going from three syllables down to two. Are we language speakers, us humans, just lazy and we're looking for shortcuts all the time?
Yeah, well, sometimes we're looking for shortcuts. But again, you're not going to cause any confusion. If you say Milwaukee instead of Milwaukee, people still know what you're talking about. It doesn't actually cause miscommunication or anything. But we always have this tension when we talk. We want to economize in certain ways. That's natural. That's fine. It's a good thing in some ways. But we also have to get our message across. So we have to say enough to convey our message, if that makes sense. So there's a real balance in that sense.
You teach a class on how immigration affects language. What kind of things do you see with immigrants coming to Wisconsin over the last, couple hundred years now?
Oh, well, a whole lot of Wisconsin English has been shaped by immigration. It's only very recently that we can really talk about there being distinct varieties of English in Wisconsin. If you go back and look at old newspapers and old books, the discussions of a Wisconsin accent are very rare. And sometimes when they say, oh, he had a Wisconsin accent, what they mean was they had a German accent or a Norwegian accent or a Polish accent. So it's pretty recent that it's come about. And a lot of features that we have in that come from immigrant speech, immigrant English, have made their way into Wisconsin English. So some things are considered that have that origin are considered sort of old-fashioned or rural today. So people who say dim over there instead of them over there has that association. But some things that come from other languages are really very robust and aren't thought of that way at all. So if you take the eastern Wisconsin use of the word once, like come here once, that is pretty clearly from German, and it doesn't have, people have just started, have picked that up, and it now marks people as being from eastern Wisconsin or other parts of the state maybe, but it's no longer associated with German, and lots of people without German background use it on a daily basis.
Now, it's easy for me to look at history and say, okay, yeah, language changed back then to what it is now, but from the vantage point of now, it seems like our language is what it is. It's locked in, but I'm wrong about that, right? It's still changing.
It's changing really fast. I'm teaching a class on language change right now and my to a bunch of undergraduates, and they're all doing projects. A whole bunch of them are doing projects on how speech is changing in Wisconsin. So one of the things that people always talk about here, right, is the pronunciation of a bag, or the same with words like agriculture, where you get people saying agriculture. Some of the students just did a study where they looked at a set of young men and women from Madison and Green Bay, and they're still doing it. This is happening now. These changes are advancing on a pretty regular basis, and other things are coming in that are very much not Wisconsin, but are quickly taking over Wisconsin. So the thing that company sleeps on is a cot, and the past tense of to catch is caught. But huge numbers of Americans don't say those things differently. They say caught for both of them, or a few people say caught for both of them. This is coming into Wisconsin pretty rapidly right now. You've got more young people saying she caught the ball, and fewer saying she caught the ball. So it's definitely happening, and it's happening really fast, and it's easy to miss it. You have to pay attention.
Let's take a quick call before we let you go. Darren is with us in Green Bay. Darren, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been here 28 years from Great Britain. Still got much of my Buckinghamshire accent. And I said to the kids one day, oh, the Milwaukee Bucks. Well, I'm from the county of Bucks. And oddly enough, the Americans would call it Buckinghamshire. But I said to the kids, the only time you say shire really is if you're talking Lord of the Rings, and that word is a standalone one. We in Buckinghamshire, actually, it's almost like we take all the vowels out and replace them with apostrophes. So we locals call ourselves Buckinghamshire. And the kids that I teach take great fun in that.
Darren, thanks a lot for that. And I've, of course, enjoyed my Worcestershire sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, a similar thing. In American English, though, it seems like we actually take those letters out and put in that apostrophe, where the British don't. Is that a thing, Joe?
Yeah, one of the things that varies a whole lot across different kinds of English is our stress patterns and where we reduce unstressed syllables. So Buckinghamshire has got that. I can't do it very well, obviously. Has got that very unreduced set of syllables that a lot of Americans find difficult to use. But we also have a lot of regional differences, right? I'm originally from the South, and we have initial stress on a lot of words like insurance and so forth. And I still, to this day, even living up here for 25, 30 years now, I still say Detroit most of the time. and not Detroit. And you note, of course, that that is not the French pronunciation. Nobody says Detroit unless they're making a joke.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joe Salmons is a professor of linguistics at UW-Madison's Department of Language Sciences. He talked to us about why we don't say Wisconsin French names like the French do. Coming up, we'll take a look at why we got all those French names in the first place, look at Wisconsin's French history and heritage. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, if you celebrate French customs here in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Though based on what we just learned, depending on who you ask, I might actually be
Rob Ferret.
Not really a French name, though. Whoever I am, we've got another Why Wisconsin question from a listener about French influence in Wisconsin. Here's a listen.
My name is Tomas Dominguez, and I'm from Maquoneago, Wisconsin. With all the French history and French names in the state, why isn't there a stronger French culture? I know that, at least in Milwaukee, there's at least one major university named after a French explorer, Marquette University. The history of the French exploring the Wisconsin territories is rather well documented. Nowadays, we think of a lot of German culture in Wisconsin, especially with all the beer brewers in the state. But why didn't the French stick around?
We're talking about why there are so many French names in Wisconsin, but why French culture and heritage not front and center. Gabrielle Verdier is Professor Emerita of French at UW-Milwaukee. She directed the Wisconsin French Connections Sesquicentennial Project and founded the Festival of Films in French at UW-Milwaukee. Gabrielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So Tomas asked there why the French didn't stick around. I guess they did some, but they don't seem to have that prominent place in Wisconsin legend now. Can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, I want to let you know that the question your listener asked is exactly the question I had when I came to Wisconsin in 1993. I was at NYU. I was offered a job here. I looked at a Wisconsin map, and I saw all of these French names. And so when I came here, I was curious about it, and that's how I came up with this project that was funded by the Sesquicentennial about Wisconsin's French connections. Now, I think that we have to go back as far as the Germans go. We all know that there were many German immigrants to Wisconsin, especially in the 19th century. When Wisconsin was becoming a state in 1848, so a big influence of German immigrants because they were leaving Germany for all sorts of economic and political reasons. The French came much earlier. The first person with a French name to arrive in Wisconsin was Jean Nicolet in 1634, and he came from Canada. So most of the French who actually came here came from the New France, the French territories in North America, the ones that they claimed in North America in the 16th century when Jacques Cartier discovered the St. Lawrence River, et cetera, and claimed a vast territory, including all the Great Lakes, for France. However, that didn't mean that they actually got to Wisconsin or anything like that. They kept on whatever French explorers they were, kept on going west in order to find, guess what, the route to India and China, right? Very famous. And Nicolet came in 1634, and when he landed in Green Bay and he saw some Native Americans, some indigenous people, he thought they were Indians from India. So even though, you know, we know the Mayflower and all that, and the English arrived on the eastern coast of the U.S. In about 17th century, the French had arrived here earlier, but they had not gotten to the very end. They had not explored to the very end. But so all of the French names came from the fact that French-speaking people were the first to arrive in that territory, which belonged to, of course, indigenous people, and gave these territories French names.
Right. It seems like a key
to get here.
Seems like a key part of the story, Gabrielle, is the French explorers were the first people to make maps, put words on them, and then share those maps. And that's why you found all those French names when you moved to Wisconsin.
Of course. The French were the first. And the French explorers, the coureurs du bois, the ones who were fur trappers and all that. And then, of course, the missionaries who came, especially the Jesuit missionaries. That's why we mentioned Marquette. So they documented things that they saw, and they sent it back to France to get support from, financial support and so on. But people did not necessarily come after that. There was a settlement in Quebec, 1608, and it was hard to get the French to move or to want to move to the New World, by the way, because it was really cold here. The territory, it was very cold. And frankly, life was not that bad in France. France was the biggest country and had the biggest agriculture of any European country. So there weren't as many famines. There wasn't as much starvation as in, for example, in Spain, or in England, in Ireland. So people were not necessarily moving to the New World for economic reasons.
So we don't have this big footprint of French settlers here. Can you talk a little bit about the contribution of those early French Canadians and later French visitors, even if they weren't settlers, to the state?
Well, mostly I would say they were French Canadians because they all came through New France through Canada in order to reach here, except when France also claimed Louisiana, and then that was in the early 18th century, and then some settlers came through Louisiana. But the contributions are, of course, there were linguistic contributions, and the fur trade was developed with the collaboration with the Native Americans, and that's one thing that the French are very distinct. That I think is their contribution, is that they did interact and they intermarried with Native Americans and quite a bit because they saw that as advantageous to the fur trade, do you see? And frankly, fur trade was the best activity in town because agriculture was more difficult for people not used to being farmers in the cold that we experience here in the upper part of North America. So that is one. Then many North Canadians who were, by the way, English. They were British, right? They had been France lost its North American territories in 1763 when it lost a big world war, which is called in the U.S. the French and Indian War. So all of these territories that were under the French crown had to be ceded back to Britain. And that's another reason why there were not many French settlers, because this whole area, Wisconsin, was no longer under French control of any kind, but it was under British control. And it is true that the British then finally the Americans were not as eager to encourage intermarriage with the Native Americans. The French were, encouraging that, actually, because they needed a population. So the French Canadians were very important in the development of the mining in northern part of Wisconsin, and very much in the lumber trade. There are many, many, many French Canadians when they were in a very bad economic situation.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks to our guest, Gabrielle Vardier, a professor emerita of French at UW-Milwaukee. She directed the Wisconsin French Connections Sesquicentennial Project and founded the Festival of Films in French at UW-Milwaukee. Thanks also to our listeners, Jan and Tomas, who sent us their questions about French language and history in Wisconsin through WPR's Why Wisconsin Project. If there's something you're curious about in the state, let us know. Submit your question at wpr.org/whywisconsin. That's like W-H-Y-Wisconsin. coming up tomorrow on Central Time. It's this week's edition of Food Friday with a focus on cheese, finding new ones, putting together a great platter, and you could share your favorites. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. After the news, a new survey about America's favorite TV sitcoms and sitcom families has us wondering which one would you most likely to be like to be a part of and why. We'll talk about what makes for a great sitcom family and give you a chance to weigh in on which one you'd like to be in. You can get started right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.